it's okay? Can you hear me? Okay. A succès d'estime in its day, the musical, The Golden Apple, was assured some sort of an afterlife with the release of an original cast album on the RCA Victor label in 1954. Set in small town Washington State following the Spanish-American War, this clever retelling of Homer's Trojan War epics has long been venerated by musical theater aficionados. Its belated reissue in CD format in 1997 was greeted with excitement and palpable relief. But why would this work, unusual in every way, even get recorded in the first place by a major American record label during the height of the ultra-conservative 1950s? By the mid-1950s, recording a cast album for a Broadway production was becoming a standard, if not quite inevitable, practice. As musical theater historian Ethan Morden has pointed out, Columbia's 1948 introduction of the LP format helped to establish the cast album as culturally central and to displace Decca as the early industry leader in cast recordings. Using the Golden Apple as its focus, in my presentation, I will discuss the rivalry that developed between the major labels, especially Columbia and RCA Victor, in the first years following the appearance of the LP. I will concentrate on the ways in which this rivalry played itself out in the field of cast recordings, demonstrating how RCA Victor aggressively fought back and briefly emerged a winner, only to be essentially vanquished by Columbia by the end of 1956. Along the way, I will reconsider the Golden Apple album itself as cultural artifact, play a very few excerpts from the show, and perhaps some other recordings. Hopefully, I'll also have an opportunity to shed some light on the Golden Apple's two little-known creators, Jerome Moros and John Latouche. I also will try to mention some of the odd connections with Seattle and Washington State shared by Moros and some other individuals associated with the show. Well, unfortunately, I don't have time to sketch out even a brief overview of the intricate relationship between the American musical theater and the recording industry, but I would like to emphasize a couple of points before I get into my discussion. Namely, with its 1943 release of Oklahoma, Decca virtually invented an iconic new product, which in its look and feel, again in the words of Morden, would function not only as souvenir for theatergoers, but as a substitute for those across the country who didn't have access to the show. The other labels were left scrambling to respond to Decca's innovation. While the competition for product heated up after 1946, it would grow even more cutthroat following Columbia's introduction of the long-playing disc. And so, with the ushering in of the LP era, the names of company executives seemed to take on an increasing prominence. Two men, each of whom had begun working at Columbia Records at about the same time that the company was acquired by William Paley, were Goddard Lieberson, who you see here in the middle of this, and Emmanuel, better known as Manny Sachs. Each would play a significant role in the development of the original cast album as a staple of a recording company's catalog. Lieberson, a trained musician and composer, rose through the ranks at Columbia to head the Masterworks Division, Columbia's classical component. He is often cited for his role in encouraging the development of the LP by engineer Paul Goldmark and getting it to market. Lost it. Sachs became Columbia's vice president and director in 1940, and he was an influential force in developing the company's popular music roster, mentoring many individual talents, including Frank Sinatra and Dinah Shore. It was under the leadership of Sachs that Columbia was able to acquire the recording rights to some of Broadway's biggest hits. Some sources claim that Sachs was responsible for creating a new business model when, instead of signing each artist separately for a cast album, as had been past practice, Columbia would give the show's producers a percentage of the royalties and sign up the entire cast for Columbia. Keep losing this thing. Sachs's approach would serve Columbia well when South Pacific became a huge bestseller, helping to establish the LP as the format of choice for the original cast album, though RCA Victor would complicate the picture somewhat with its introduction of the 45 RPM disc in 1949. But by April 1950, the album was reported to have earned Columbia some $4 million. At the beginning of that same year, RCA Victor had poached Sax from Columbia. In late 1949, Lieberson had been promoted to executive vice president of Columbia. The stage was now set for the next phase in the development of the original cast album. It can be useful to see the development of the Broadway musical during the 1950s as being bracketed on both ends of the decade by two hit shows starring Ethel Merman, Call Me Madam and Gypsy. The former was a well-crafted but essentially ephemeral product, while the latter arguably represents the Broadway musical at its peak. The difference between the recordings of the two shows is equally instructive. Columbia's original cast album of Gypsy captures and preserves the sound and feeling of the show in its entirety. Call Me Madam, however, is a completely different story. In order to obtain the rights to the show, Sax had astutely invested Victor's money in the production of Call Me Madam, returning a sizable profit to the company when the show became a hit. However, when it came to making the recording, Decca would not release Ethel Merman from her exclusive contract. Victor forged ahead and released an album featuring one of its contracted stars, Dinah Shore, singing Merman's role of Sally Adams, along with the rest of the original Broadway cast. Decca followed up with its own release, with Merman, backed by the Gordon Jenkins Orchestra, supported by Dick Hames and other Decca singers who weren't in the show. The result, while sometimes interesting listening, in its very inauthenticity, has left a highly compromised documentation of the show. It was a situation that would have been almost unthinkable by the end of the decade. Between 1950 and 1954, nearly every musical that was produced on Broadway was given an original cast recording. All four major labels eagerly participated in bidding wars to secure the recording rights to the latest show. In the process, each had assembled a fairly indiscriminate catalog of show albums by 1954. If we compare the output of each label during those years, we could safely characterize each list as being a mixed bag containing some hits, some middling successes, and some outright flops. Decca seems to maintain an early lead, issuing such hits as Guys and Dolls in 1950 and The King and I in 1951. Capitol appears associated with flops like 1951's Flahoolie, though it also snared the 1953 hit Can Can. But it's RCA Victor who gives the impression of being the most aggressive, snapping up shows which must have seemed strong candidates for success, but which unfortunately fizzled out. Shows such as 1951's Make-A-Wish, the most expensive Broadway musical to date, or 1953's Me and Juliet, Rodgers and Hammerstein's latest effort. Only Columbia remains slightly removed from the original cast album Frenzy. In his new role with the company, Lieberson chose to mine the symbiotic relationship between the Broadway musical stage and the recording industry in a slightly different vein. In 1950, he tapped experienced Broadway conductor Lehman Engel to embark on a series of recreations of historic shows, utilizing a studio cast and some of the original orchestrations. In developing its line of studio cast albums, Lieberson helped to establish a particular profile for Columbia in its relationship to the evolving Broadway canon, one unmistakably identified with quality and selectivity. However, with the interplay between the recording industry and the Broadway musical during these years growing increasingly complex, it's difficult to chart a simple cause and effect relationship. Following Sax's lead, by 1954, it had become routine practice for a record label to become a part investor in the show or to offer extravagant tie-ins to induce the show's producers to assign the recording rights to a particular label. The record company's ability to draw from their roster of popular recording artists to produce singles of show songs for radio and jukebox play became an important part of the package. For example, it has been suggested that RCA Victor's successful pushing of Eddie Fisher's single of the title song from Wish You Were Here during the summer of 1952.
Just get a little bit closer to the microphone.
For example, it has been suggested that RCA Victor's successful pushing of Eddie Fisher's single of the title song from Wish You Were Here during the summer of 1952 may have played a role in helping that show, which had received mainly negative reviews, continue on for a respectable Broadway run. However, the disparity between the potential market for popular singers and original cast albums was already striking. In March 1954, for example, the original cast album of Kismet was reported to have sold a solid 65,000 copies for Columbia, while Tony Bennett's hit single of Stranger in Paradise from that same show had sold copies in the hundreds of thousands. Clearly, by the mid-1950s, the Broadway songbook was translating into bigger business opportunities than ever before. It was in the midst of this overheated marketplace that the Golden Apple finally made its appearance. Unlike most Broadway shows of its time, the Golden Apple endured an unusually long gestation period. The second collaboration between composer Jerome Moras and lyricist John Latouche, the Golden Apple had been partially developed under the auspices of a Guggenheim Fellowship. Latouche and Moras first met in the 1930s. Each received his first taste of acclaim through productions sponsored by the Federal Theater Project. Recommended by Aaron Copland, Moras created the score for Ruth Page's Americana-infused ballet, Frankie and Johnny, in 1938 in Chicago. Latouche's Ballad for Uncle Sam was used as the finale for an off-Broadway review, Sing for Your Supper, in 1939. Renamed Ballad for Americans, the cantata, co-written with Earl Robinson, was soon recorded by Bing Crosby and, in a possibly more familiar version, by Paul Robeson. Latouche and Moras quickly became interested in working together, but other commitments, as well as the Second World War, intervened. In 1940, Moras began to work in Hollywood as an orchestrator. He later would write complete film scores. In addition to film work, Moras continued to compose for the concert stage. The Seattle Symphony premiered his Symphony No. 1 in 1943 under the baton of Sir Thomas Beecham during his brief but controversial tenure as the orchestra's director. John Latouche teamed up with the composer Vernon Duke in 1940 on Cabin in the Sky, which introduced the standard Taking a Chance on Love. They followed up with two less successful Broadway shows before World War II disrupted Latouche's burgeoning theatrical career. Following his military service, Latouche became immersed in several successive Broadway projects, most notably a 1946 collaboration with Duke Ellington, The Beggar's Holiday, which was based on the Beggar's Opera. 1948 finally saw the Broadway premiere of the show on which Latouche had been working intermittently with Moras over several years, Ballet Ballads. Deliberately designed by its creators to push the boundaries of musical theater, Ballet Ballads was never a likely candidate for commercial success. Consisting of separate segments, Ballet Ballads had no spoken dialogue. Its stories were conveyed solely through song and dance. The show received glowing reviews during its initial limited off-Broadway engagement before beginning an open-ended run on Broadway, where it would stagger through less than 2 months of performances at the Music Box Theater during the hot summer of 1948. More forgotten than even the Golden Apple, perhaps made more so because it didn't receive a cast album, the groundbreaking Ballet Ballads nevertheless helped to set a pattern that would be repeated in the later show. Sustained in part by their Guggenheim fellowships, Latouche and Moras had begun working on the Golden Apple at about the same time that Ballet Ballads had gone into production. The idea for the project had originated with Latouche. Despite some significant delays, the work was substantially complete by the end of 1950. Several producers expressed interest in bringing it to the stage, but it took nearly 100 backers auditions and over 3 years for the show to get produced. In the end, the off-Broadway Phoenix Theater came to the rescue. So what greeted those intrepid Phoenix first-nighters who made the trek down to a former Yiddish theater on 2nd Avenue on March 11th, 1954? ¶¶
On Mount Olympus in Washington State, the town of Angel's Roost feels great. The war with Spain at last is through, and Penelope waits for her boy in blue.
Well, it wasn't that, but Latouche set the action in the fictional town of Angel's Roost, Washington, a location chosen because a consultation of the Atlas had revealed that the state contained a Mount Olympus. And here you see the real Mount Olympus. I don't have time to give you a whole synopsis of the show, but I'm going to run through a few slides quickly to give you some sense of the look of the production. I also have given you a copy of the synopsis that was included with the original cast album as a handout. Act One of The Golden Apple covers some of the same ground as the Iliad, chiefly the lead up to the Trojan War. Its characters are turn-of-the-century American equivalents of Homer's mythological character. For example, here we see the Aphrodite figure, Lovey Mars, the Athena figure, Miss Minerva Oliver, and Penelope, Ulysses' wife, and Helen, who in this story is now the archetypal farmer's daughters. And they're played here by B.B. Osterwald, Portia Nelson, Priscilla Gillette, and Kay Ballard. As the show begins, one war has ended, and the town is making preparations to welcome the returning heroes home with a county fair. But after the men return, all the trouble begins. A traveling salesman from the nearby seaport of Rhododendron, Mr. Paris, arrives in a hot air balloon. The women ask Paris to judge a baked goods competition, and Paris runs off with Helen as his prize. Ulysses and the men set off on a mission to Rhododendron to bring Helen back, as the first act concludes. The second act shifts the action to Rhododendron and quickly dispatches the rest of the action of the Iliad. This version of the Trojan War is staged as a prize fight in which Ulysses, standing in for Menelaus, beats Paris. The rest of the act mirrors the Odyssey, as what starts out as a Saturday night victory celebration turns into a 10-year spree. In a series of fast-moving episodes that parallel the books of the Odyssey, the companions are picked off one by one. Here we see the final encounter with Circe, the woman without mercy, after which Ulysses is left completely on his own. He finally makes his way home and convinces an angry and reluctant Penelope to try to continue their life together as the show concludes. Well, what sort of critical reception did this clearly unusual show receive? Sensing that something unusual and extraordinary indeed had taken place, the New York critics greeted the Phoenix production with almost unanimously enthusiastic reviews. The Journal American hailed it as being some sort of milestone in the American musical theater. The Daily News summed it up as the best thing that has happened in and to the theater in a very long time. And the Daily Mirror attempted to put it all into perspective. The Golden Apple strikes us as being the most important musical since Oklahoma. Buoyed by these excellent notices, preparations began during the Phoenix run to polish the apple for a quick move uptown. Fully expectant of repeating its off-Broadway success and armed with a New York Drama Critics Circle Award, the show opened on April 20th at the Alvin Theater, where it eked out a disappointing 125 performances before closing on August 7th. The producers took the show to Washington for a two-week engagement at the outdoor Carter Barron Amphitheater and briefly considered touring and reopening on Broadway at a later date, but having taken a reported loss of over $100,000 on the Broadway production, they evidently decided that it was not worth the further risk. Following the staging in Washington, the Golden Apple folded for good. Fortunately for us, however, on April 2nd, a deal for recording the cast album had been struck with RCA Victor, and the recording itself was made about a week in advance of the Broadway opening. The deal for the recording rights to The Golden Apple appears to have been fairly typical for the period, although the royalties were perhaps a bit lower than what was offered to artists with a more proven track record. Perhaps in an effort to sweeten the deal, however, Manny Sachs had made at least one notable concession. As agent Lucy Kroll, who negotiated the contract, wrote to producer Alfred Deliagra, "I thought that you would be happy to know that Eddie Fisher is recording Lazy Afternoon together with some of the other songs." Could Eddie Fisher do for the Golden Apple what he had done for Wish You Were Here? Well, faced with the challenge of presenting a score containing over 2 hours worth of music and some 30 individual songs within the confines of a single long-playing disc, the producers decided to leave out several complete numbers from the show, and many of those songs that were included were offered in a truncated form. But cutting, shortening, or rearranging the order of numbers was from how they were actually presented on the Broadway stage was hardly atypical of the original cast album as it had developed by the mid-1950s. To provide some additional continuity, Latouche supplied several rhyming narrative couplets, supposedly knocked off during the session itself, which were read by Jack Whiting. You heard part of one earlier. Again, this practice was not without precedent. For example, on the Victor, Call Me Madam cast album, Paul Lucas, the nominal remaining star from the Broadway production, provides some short narration before a few of the numbers. One keeps waiting for him to explain Merman's absence. The recording session for The Golden Apple took place on Monday, April the 12th, at one of the Manhattan Center studios of RCA Victor. Typically, original cast albums were recorded over the course of an entire day, and the Golden Apple session followed this pattern. I had an opportunity to speak with Alan Siegel, who played first trumpet for the original production, about this experience. He recalled in particular how the producers had left the recording of the challenging overture, which some of you might have heard at the beginning, for the very end of the session. The young Siegel, who was only 21 at the time, was encouraged by some of the more veteran musicians to prolong the recording session and earn them all some valuable overtime pay by dropping a mute or messing up the take in some other way. But determined to prove his chops, Siegel remembers that he was able to get through that difficult passage, and it is difficult, in one perfect take. The Golden Apple album undoubtedly gives a very distorted representation of the show. Scanning through contemporary reviews, one of the consistent cavils about the show had been that the music, while admirable, was not catchy. Perhaps the theater arts reviewer summed it up best. "There is no single show-stopping tune to gather the coin of the jukebox realm." Among the songs most frequently cited by the critics as being among the show's more accessible were Lazy Afternoon, The Comic Seduction of Helen, Guna Guna, a Hawaiian number sung by the siren, and It's the Going Home Together, a duet on the joys of marriage and companionship. Let's examine these three numbers as they appear on the recording in a bit more detail. Lazy Afternoon, of course, was the only song from the show to emerge as a standard, described by musicologist Charles Turner as that rare popular song which appeals both to mainstream singers and to more eclectic, jazz-oriented stylists. Lazy Afternoon was subsequently recorded by a number of singers. It's usually associated with sophisticated cabaret performers, such as Marlena Dietrich, who recorded it shortly after the show was produced, or Mabel Mercer, for whom it became a signature song. The original cast album version by Kay Ballard certainly comes as a revelation to anyone who is most familiar with her work on television shows, such as The Mothers-in-Law. And it's pretty long, so I'll just play you a few seconds of it, hopefully. Oh, 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 it's a lazy afternoon, and the beetle bugs are zooming, and the tulip trees are blooming, and there's not another human in view. But us two, it's a lazy afternoon, and the farmer leaves his reaping, and the meadow cows are sleeping, and the speckled trout stop leaping upstream as we dream.
You can hear the grass as it grows.
I have to cut you off, Kate. Okay. Next song is Guna Guna, or called variously by Guna Guna Lagoon on the different versions of the release. Given the 1950s vogue for frequently inane novelty songs, it's surprising that Victor did not try to push this title. Perhaps it may have had to do with the lyrics, which, unexpurgated, might not have gotten much airplay. I'll let you be the judge.
Bye, Aguna, Gona, Gona. By a guna, 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 lagoon. We will croona, croona, croona. We will croona, croona real jungle tune. Upon that golden shore, kids, we'll lie on beds of orchids. And then later, by the crater of an old volcano, we can promise we won't say no one, no one. Let's a goa, let's a goa, goa, go away soon. Where breezes blow a, blow a, blow a, breezes blow a like a big, big bassoon. Snug as two baboons in a bamboo tree. I'll bamboozle you and you'll bamboozle me by a guna. Guna, guna, by a guna, 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 la guna.
Sorry. Finally, we have It's the Going Home Together, which is clearly central to the Golden Apple. It is initially heard as a first act duet between Penelope and Ulysses following his return from the war. On the album, it is also reprised as a very abrupt finale into which the full cast joins. At first, this reads like a cynical record company decision. However, in this instance, the ending of the Golden Apple recording was quite faithful to the Broadway, if not the off-Broadway theatergoers' experience of the production. Responding to the suggestions of some critics, the Broadway producers had insisted on changing the show's original ending. Instead of simply concluding with "We've Just Begun," an uneasy duet of reconciliation for Ulysses and Penelope, the producers dropped that song and opted for a more formulaic full cast reprise of It's the Going Home Together to conclude the show. Having recently seen the original ending performed, I would say that it makes far more dramatic sense, but the record's reprise of It's the Going Home Together certainly serves its purpose admirably as a finale. And I'll play the finale for you at the end, but I have to keep moving. All in all, the Golden Apple album probably works as well as possible within its given set of limitations, but perhaps that was just the problem. RCA Victor treated this very special show as just another typical product. For example, the initial press release finds the publicity department struggling for a coherent marketing angle for the record. The appearance of the Broadway production frustrated their attempts to hype the recording as being the first time that the off-Broadway theater is on records. The newspaper ad campaign, which you see here, further underscores authenticity as being the keynote of the original cast recording, actually sung and played by the stars who made The Golden Apple the year's greatest hit. It's not surprising, then, that The Golden Apple would get lost in the marketing shuffle, when in an ironic twist, as the 1953-54 Broadway season was drawing to its close, Columbia and Victor apparently switched their roles. As noted by Variety, the current season had offered the disc companies meager pickings, but that situation was about to improve slightly. On the schedule for April was The Pajama Game, the first Broadway project for the pop music team of Richard Adler and Jerry Ross, and as of March, its rights still had not been picked up by any record company. Not even on the Broadway horizon at that point was The Golden Apple. Strangely enough, it was Columbia that nabbed the solid commercial success, The Pajama Game, which it marketed quite effectively, while Victor wound up with the prestige item. The 1954-55 Broadway season would bring forth a greater number of musicals, and Victor went on the offensive, snatching the original cast recording rights to the next Adler and Ross show, Damn Yankees, away from Columbia, and rushing it to market in a record turnaround of less than 48 hours after the recording. But that coup only served to cap what already had become an enormously productive season for the company. In another display of synergy and muscle on the part of Victor and NBC, the landmark telecast of Peter Pan with Mary Martin helped to boost sales of that original cast album. Assessing the season as a whole, in sheer volume alone, Victor held a huge edge over Columbia, also taking down Silk Stockings and Fanny. Columbia's sole original cast album of that season was the innovative House of Flowers, which had only a brief run on Broadway. But the 1955-56 season would prove to be an annus mirabilis of sorts for Columbia, decisively changing the dynamic. For that season brought with it My Fair Lady. Lieberson had gotten CBS to capitalize the entire production, thereby bringing all of the profits from the phenomenally best-selling cast album, as well as those generated by the vast network of Columbia tie-in products, back to the corporation. Perhaps feeling generous, Lieberson also was able to accord Frank Lesser's long and complex score for The Most Happy Fella the kind of lavish treatment that had been denied to the Golden Apple. Columbia released an unprecedented 3-LP disc set that recorded practically the entire show. In that same year, Columbia even took down perhaps the decade's most celebrated succès d'estame, Leonard Bernstein's Candide. In 1956, Lieberson was named president of Columbia Records. I'll just skip to the last slide since I'm getting the time signal. The Golden Apple has been produced off-Broadway a few times, has received numerous amateur productions, and more recently has started to receive some concert stagings. In 1960, RCA Victor would lease the distribution rights to the recording to Elektra Records for a 4-year period. The Elektra release, in some ways, definitively established the Golden Apple as an off-Broadway cast album, effectively repositioning it as a coterie item. That LP went out of print for many years, but in the hands of collectors, the cult of the Golden Apple could still be stoked through endless replaying. In some ways, the Golden Apple was a little ahead of its time, but we can be grateful at least that it came along at a unique and peculiar cultural moment that enabled it to have some sort of survival through its original cast album. The mid-1950s saw the initial flowering of the original cast album as a concept, but its centrality to popular culture was only to be short-lived. Though the American musical theater would continue to reach new heights, by the end of the decade, the original cast album would begin its inevitable marginalization into a niche market item, but one which could still be brought home through the changing years in that most tangible of forms. Thank you.